for the sermon, Mr. Steve Buchanan.
Thank you, Mr. Bishoner, and good afternoon to all of you. Greetings from Sierra Vista and El Paso. We had good service down there, had some guests down in Sierra Vista today, so it was always nice to have a few new faces, a few from Phoenix attended, so it's good to see that. And it's our attendance has kind of dropped recently there for various reasons, but it was good to see that everything went well, and glad to hear that they had a great night to be much observed and holy day observance on the first day. On the first holy day, I gave a sermon that I titled The Man of Sin Revealed. If you didn't hear it and you'd like to, you can listen to it on the website locally, or you can check it out on a CD. I suppose we'll have it copied. I think it might already be up, but I don't know. But eventually, apparently, it will be up. And the only reason I say that is because you can miss a sermon, obviously, but if you wanted to hear it, it's in tandem with the one that I'm giving today, also another sermon on prophecy, which I mentioned on the first holy day. My intention on giving prophecy during the days of the time of unleavened bread is to highlight a time of sin that is going to descend upon the world. Now, we don't know when it's going to happen. It could be in a few short years, and you might think, well, how could it be too far off in the future? But the fact is, we just don't know. We've probably always felt that way, though, haven't we? We think that the future and prophetic fulfillment is just around the corner, especially when world events seem to be heating up. I've asked the men to distribute to everybody what we have affectionately come to call the beast chart. It's out of the booklet that Mr. Armstrong wrote years ago entitled Who is the Beast? It's still accurate, too, by the way. Nobody has ever disproven it, because most of that is the historical fulfillment of the revivals of the Holy Roman Empire. And so you don't have to look at it as if it's the most important thing in the world. Probably a lot of you have copies of it in your Bible, but if you do want to look at it as if it's the most important thing in the world, that's great. It's for reference purposes today as well. Any little shiny trinket to keep you involved, that's that's my purpose here. But I thought it would actually be helpful as we go through some of the information today. The days of unleavened bread illustrate the difference between sin. The leavening agents represent sin for us during this particular time of the year. And these days highlight that difference between leaven and unleavened bread. And we are commanded to eat unleavened bread during this particular time, during the 7 days of unleavened bread, to picture putting on righteousness, putting on the righteousness of Jesus Christ. Now, oftentimes, it seems as though the contrast between the two seems to be blurred within society. It should never be that way for the people of God. But the contrast is going to get in the divide, you might say, between sin and unrighteousness as time goes on and towards the times of the end is going to be even larger than it is now. But the deception of the time is going to be so great that many people will not be able to discern the difference. But the good news is the people of God will be able to discern the difference. Now, along with the man of sin that was highlighted during the first sermon of this particular series, we know, you know, I know, that there's going to be another prominent figure that is going to figure importantly in the world stage. And the Bible shows that this individual is going to have great political, economic, military, and religious power at his disposal. And this individual has been called by the Bible a beast, a leader who is a beast, but it's also synonymous with kingdom. The terminology beast is also synonymous with kingdom. And so we have seen that through the study of the book of Revelation and the book of Daniel. And the question today is, what will be the characteristics of that individual who is called the beast? And what are going to be the characteristics of the beast power? Who will be the beast, and what will be the characteristics of the beast? We'll pick off, we'll start in a passage that we left off last time, maybe not the last scripture, but in Daniel chapter 8, a very interesting prophecy that I'll try to add a little bit more detail to this particular chapter, which I wasn't able to really get into a lot of detail. That wasn't the purpose of the Sermon on the Man of Sin. But just to highlight the times that we will move into in the future, who knows when exactly, although there have been some interesting things that have been happening in the news recently regarding these particular events, perhaps forerunners to those things, just things that maybe as an individual you might be thinking of. I don't think they're the fulfillment of prophecy, obviously, at this particular time, and I think you'll see why as we move through the rest of the sermon, as we talk about the characteristics of the beast, but certainly very interesting and attention-getting on the world scene as well. But Daniel 8 in verse 23 says, "In the latter time of their kingdom, when transgressors have reached their fullness..." It hasn't happened yet. It's going to be during the time of the end, during the time around, just prior to, around that time, or within the last 3.5 years on this earth. It says, "Transgressors have reached their fullness. A king shall arise, having fierce features, who understands sinister schemes." The world is going to plunge in the few years ahead. We don't know when, 5, 10, 15, 20, is going to plunge into a time of darkness that this world has never seen before, for reasons that I explained last week regarding the unleashing of satanic power on a scale that we have not seen. 2 Thessalonians 2 says that that power has been restrained. Paul explains that that power has been restrained, but there is going to come a time, and it's backed up in the book of Revelation, and we'll see that later on, that that power is going to be unleashed on mankind, and there is going to be a power of darkness, a power of sin that is going to come on the world. His power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. It's going to be satanically contrived. He shall destroy fearfully and shall prosper and thrive. He shall destroy the mighty, also the holy people. That could refer to God's people. It could refer to the Jews in an oblique reference as well. Through his cunning, he shall cause deceit to prosper under his rule, and he shall exalt himself in his heart. He shall destroy many in their prosperity. He shall even rise against the prince of princes, but he shall be broken without human means. Now, here is the interesting part of this particular prophecy, and there are some detail involved with it, but it's not anything you can't understand. If you feel like, oh, wow, it's been a while since I've studied that particular passage of prophecy before, you can easily get a handle on it with a quick review. The vision of the evenings and the mornings which was told is true. Therefore, seal up the vision, for it refers to many days in the future. One of the things that we do know about prophecy is that there are typical fulfillments of a prophecy that is uttered by any of the prophets. Sometimes those things have already been fulfilled. In this case, this particular prophecy of the 2300 days and nights, or days, it's called, because it appears in another translation, the prophecy of 2300 days, has already been fulfilled twice in history. One, I'll cover both of them a little bit later. But in the beginning of chapter 8 of Daniel, we read of a dream that Daniel has that is a vision of prophecy that is going to be fulfilled not in his lifetime, but several hundred years after he dies. And so in Daniel 8, if you'll begin reading there first of all, or now this is the second passage, "In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared to me, Daniel, after the one that appeared to me the first time. I saw in the vision, and it so happened that while I was looking, I was in Shushan, the citadel, which is in the province of Elam. And I saw in the vision that I was by the river Ulai. Then I lifted my eyes and saw there, standing beside the river, was a ram which had two horns." The Persian Empire had already conquered the Babylonian Empire, to which Daniel had been taken captive. This particular prophecy speaks of that particular conquering, ruling government that he was living in, and it's pictured by this ram that has two horns, signifying duality of the Medo-Persian Empire. It says, but one was higher than the other, and the higher one came up last. And I saw a ram push. I saw the ram pushing westward, northward, and southward, so that no animal could withstand him, nor was there any that could deliver from his hand. But he did according to his will and became great. I won't cover all the passages in this chapter, but these particular animals are described and they're explained a little bit later. And as I was considering, suddenly a male goat came from the west across the surface of the earth. So Daniel is now in Persia, and this goat is coming from the west, or as we know now, and this is no real secret, by the way. When I first read of these things and these prophecies being explained by Mr. Armstrong, we basically had a corner on prophecy. But historians actually had understood the fulfillment of this particular prophecy from a historical standpoint for many, many years. And so this information in Daniel 8 is not particular to the Church of God, United Church of God, or any Church of God for that matter, because it's well known among Bible scholars that these particular fulfillments did take place in history, and they understood this. And they understood that this goat that was coming from the west was actually the armies of Alexander the Great. And in the 320s BC, that army was very fast moving and moved across from west to east all the way to India and conquered everything in between. And it was a very, very powerful force. And so much was accomplished by Alexander so quickly in his life that he was discouraged that there was nothing left to conquer. And yet he died very early, about age 33 or so. And then the kingdom, as it mentions in verse 9, after this goat grew very great, and when he became strong, the large horn was broken in its place, four notable ones. Virtually everyone who is a student of Bible history realizes, so we should realize it too. We should know that there were four generals that replaced Alexander the Great, and his kingdom was divided amongst his main four generals. Ptolemy, who was one of those generals who ruled Egypt, parts of Syria and Judea. Seleucus of the Seleucid dynasty that descended from him, who ruled another part of Syria, Babylon, and the territory east to India. Lysimachus, who ruled Asia Minor, that would be the area of Turkey and the surrounding areas. And then Cassander, or Antipater, who ruled Greece and Macedonia. And so those four generals took over, and that is what this prophecy speaks about. Eventually, these kingdoms combined into two. One was the Seleucid dynasty, and then the other was the rulership by the Ptolemies. Cleopatra the Great was of the Ptolemy or the Ptolemic dynasty. So in the last message, I referred to this 2300 days prophecy in Daniel 8, but I didn't have time to elaborate on it at the time. So verse 9 shows that there would be this little horn which grew exceedingly great toward the south and the east toward the glorious land. This horn also represented a kingdom, and it took away the daily sacrifices, or it would take away the daily sacrifices. I briefly mentioned that the daily sacrifices described by the book of Maccabees, now, the daily sacrifices were taken away from the temple by the Seleucid dynasty, represented at this time by Antiochus the fourth. I'm getting ahead of myself. These Roman numerals pop up in my notes, and so... But it was Antiochus the fourth, and he came in, as described in the last sermon, he came into Jerusalem, overthrew the land, and much of the history has been saved by non-canonical books of the Bible, such as Maccabees the first, which detail some of the history that happened at that particular time. In verse 13, it says, "Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to that certain one who was speaking." So these are two angels who are speaking. "How long until this vision is fulfilled concerning the daily sacrifices and the transgression of desolation, the giving of both the sanctuary and the host to be trampled underfoot?" Now, interestingly enough, if you have any sense of the chronology of the events of what happened, you'll know that the Jews were taken captive from a period of time of 606 to 586 or thereabouts you know, the dates change according to the historian that you look at. They were taken in three waves of captivity through that particular time period, from Judah to Babylon. And in the meantime, as they were being taken captive, the Babylonians came in and they destroyed the temple of God that Solomon had been entrusted to build. From David's plans to Solomon building it, that temple was destroyed. At the time of Daniel's prophecy, prophesying of a time that there would be a cessation of the sacrifices in Jerusalem, there was no temple. Daniel was given this vision, and that is how it sounded and looked to him to be so fantastic, because he's looking into the future and he knows that the temple had been destroyed. He realizes that at that time, because other captives had come in after him. He was in the first wave of those that were taken captive to Babylon, served in the court of Nebuchadnezzar, along with three other individuals who were bright and skillful and learned. But there wasn't a temple at that time. We know from the books of Daniel, Ezra, Nehemiah, and Haggai that the Jews were returned under King Darius's decree, and they came back. 70 years after the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem, they began work on it again, and eventually it was finished around 516 to 515 BC. All of those books figure in that detail. Some of them were allowed to go back. They rebuilt the temple and completed it about 516 BC. But that was still prior to this particular prophecy that Daniel gave. Now, there were several fulfillments of this prophecy, which, as we understand, is a principle of prophecy, the typical fulfillment, the end time fulfillment, maybe several fulfillments. Oftentimes, this is the case. The first time this prophecy was fulfilled was in 167 to 168 BC, when this Antiochus IV, a descendant of the Seleucid dynasty, came into Jerusalem and utterly destroyed the city and destroyed actually many lives. Maccabees, 1 Maccabees, describes the actions of Antiochus. In 1 Maccabees 1 and verse 41, please turn to that now. Oh, you don't have a Catholic Bible. You don't have those uninspired books. But I'll read it to you. You can look it up if you'd like to. You want to check. The king then issued a proclamation to his whole kingdom that all were to become a single people, each nation renouncing its particular customs. You know, this is what Gentile leaders do. They rule with absolute power. They're, you know, and it's hard for us to understand because we have lived in a society that is relatively free and gives us that kind of freedom. All Gentiles conformed to the king's decree, and many Israelites chose to accept his religion, sacrificing to idols and profaning the Sabbath. The king also sent edicts by messenger to Jerusalem and the towns of Judah, directing them to adopt customs foreign to the country, banning burnt offerings, sacrifices, and libations from the sanctuary, profaning Sabbaths and feasts, defiling the sanctuary and everything holy, building altars, shrines, and temples for idols, so that they should forget the law and revoke all observances of it. Anyone not obeying the king's command was to be put to death. And now, from the continuing on in verse 44 of 1 Maccabees, punishment was swift and brutal. Women who had had their sons circumcised were killed and their babies hung around their necks. Anyone continuing in faithful obedience to God was executed. Not content merely to stop the sacrifices, Antiochus desecrated the temple. A bearded image of the pagan deity Jupiter Olympus was set up in the temple altar. The Jews popularly spoke of this as the abomination of desolation. Greek soldiers and their paramours performed licentious heathen rites in the very temple courts. Swine were sacrificed on the altar. This was a prophecy that Daniel uttered. It was later on, hundreds of years, fulfilled by Antiochus IV. It's a partial fulfillment of a type that will happen at the time of the end. Now, on the sermon regarding the man of sin, I also referenced a secondary fulfillment that occurred just over 30 years past the time of Jesus Christ's ministry, just over 30 years, just over his last observance of the Passover and the time just prior to that with his disciples. I'm not turning there, but we turned last time to Luke 21, which Christ instructed his disciples also there, and in Matthew 24, that when they were to see these types of events happen, that they should get out of Jerusalem. And that's exactly what happened. I described that the Roman army marched toward Jerusalem in AD 66, and they came within sight of the city, and then they pulled back. At that time, those who were in the church, history records that they fled, moved out of the city of Jerusalem and were spared. And upwards of 1 million Jews were killed several years later as the Romans came back, and this time led by armies, with armies led by Vespasian. True to the Mount Olivet prophecy, the city of Jerusalem and the temple was made desolate. In fact, it was razed to the ground. And another interesting sidelight is that Christ said that not one stone would be left upon another, and part of that reason is that in the burning of the temple and any of the gold goblets that were used in the offerings all melted away because the heat was so fierce. And of course, if you're a soldier and you're depending on the Roman army to give you a salary, and it's basically salt and whatever else you're given as your daily rations, they sifted through all of those massive stones to find all of that melted gold that they could. Now, verse 14 of this chapter 8 says, "He said to me, 'For 2,300 days, then the sanctuary shall be cleansed.'" It may say in your margin, if you have a New King James Bible, "evenings and mornings." There were evening and morning sacrifices. So 2,300 evening and morning sacrifices equals 1,150 days. And true enough, about 1,100, well, actually, exactly 1,150 days after the temple was desecrated, and it remained desecrated by Antiochus Epiphanes, 1,150 days later, the Maccabean revolt took full force, and they were able to expunge the dictator. They were able to get rid of them, and for a period of time, all the way up until the time of Christ's day, they were not oppressed. Of course, the Romans came later on, as we know, and they were subject to Rome, because now Rome was now the world-ruling power and not the Greco-Macedonian power that had preceded them. So literally, the meaning is evenings and mornings. So the time of the sacrifices that they were stopped was 1,150 days until it was cleansed by the Maccabeans. Verse 26, though, is the real key in understanding all of this in terms of its end-time fulfillment, because it says, "And the vision of the evenings and the mornings, which was told, is true. Therefore, seal up the vision, for it refers to many days in the future," or to the time of the end. It had a partial fulfillment. It had a secondary fulfillment, but it also referred to the time of the end. So that's the explanation. Daniel chapter 12 and verse 11 seems to show a slightly different time frame, and that is why I think we can be pretty adamant maybe as you could be about something that's not, that maybe seems to have a little bit of a gray area, because it's, and I say that because it's hard for us to imagine a time in which the Jews will be offering sacrifices once again. But it's not hard when you see that these many instances, the vision refers to the latter times, and then this prophecy as well, where it says in verse 11, "And from the time that the daily sacrifice is taken away, and the abomination of desolation is set up, there shall be 1,290 days." Evidently, that last day is ending in the return of Jesus Christ. So just after 3.5 years, "Blessed is he who waits," a month after 3.5 years, "blessed is he who waits and comes to the 1,335 days." So you tack on another 45 days, and it has the same ending point, apparently. So a slightly different time frame, not the 2,300 days prophecy, but 1,290 days, apparently. Now, what will this leader do? In the book of Deuteronomy, we know that it is a restatement of the law of God that was given to Moses and the children of Israel at Mount Sinai. It's a restatement to a generation that wasn't there the first time, or maybe were young, very, very young, 40 years earlier when that law was first given at Sinai. And so it's a good idea to rehearse the terms of the covenant before you go into the land. This is what is required of you. This is what is expected of you. And so Deuteronomy means repeat. Deutero, it's just to emphasize what that law was. And so a whole book is written on the repetition of the law. In chapter 6 of Deuteronomy, in verse 1, as an overall statement, it says, "Now this is the commandment, and these are the statutes and the judgments which the Lord your God has commanded to teach you, that you may observe them in the land which you are crossing over to possess. And these words which I command you today shall be in your heart." It was always God's intention for the law to be resting in the mind, the attitude, not just from a physical standpoint of observance, but they would be in their heart. And of course, Christ said, you know, how often he had wished to, when he looked out into Jerusalem, disobedient Jerusalem, how often he wished to take them under his wings as a mother hen. You know, oh, that there would be such a heart in them, God expressed. "These words which I command you today shall be in your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children and shall talk of them when you sit in the house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise up. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be frontlets between your eyes." The commands of God are active in both mind and body. As was illustrated in the sermonette, the law is incumbent upon us not only from the physical standpoint of things, not just the physical observance of doing this, doing that. It's also important from the mental aspect of how we employ the mind of God ourselves that we are given to. God's people are expected to do that. They're in the forehead. They're in the actions of an individual. You know, how you work, how you perform. Your physical actions are represented by your hands. Your thought process is represented by your mind. You're supposed to keep God's law ever in mind. And so it's not just good enough not to commit murder anymore. You cannot hate. You cannot hate without breaking the law of God, because that's just like murder. And so that's very, very important. And that is a part of the Days of Unleavened Bread, the expansion of God's law. And so, wow, you mean, you hear a story about somebody that is willing to, has a good circumstance. I mean, everything worked out well for this individual in the story of the sermonette. And he did what the law required of him in a spiritual way, in a sense, and that is what we are supposed to do. That is what the Days of Unleavened Bread represent. It's okay to find physical leaven. It's okay to get leaven out of your homes. All of that is finding, but have you had the chance to examine yourself from a spiritual standpoint during these times? Examine your mind, your mental approach, your attitude, your thought process. How are you doing? Well, all of us could say, wow, I could do a lot better than what I am doing because I'm not cognizant of this. I'm selfish in this way. I don't do this right. I'm not thinking properly. But at least you're aware of it, and at least you're striving to do it. The commandments of God are active both in mind and body. Now, Daniel chapter 7 and verse 25, we've read this a couple of times now in the last couple of weeks. But Daniel 7 and verse 25 is a prophecy that shows that the little horn or the man of sin would do something in regard to God's appointed times. Daniel 7 and in verse 25. This little horn, which we described, it's also mentioned as the other beast in the book of Revelation in chapter 13. He shall speak pompous words against the Most High, shall persecute the saints of the Most High, and shall intend to change times and law. Then the saints shall be given into his hand for a time, times, and half a time. The people of God, at least some of them at some point or another, are going to be involved with this man of sin. And this individual is in the time of the end, going to change the day of worship and enforce it as the Bible shows. The mark of the beast is going to be enforced upon all of the world, and all commerce is going to have to do with that. Now, in this day and age, well, let me back up. In earlier years in the church, maybe going back to the 50s and 60s, I heard stories when I came into the church in the early 70s of people who had lost their job because they would not work on the Sabbath. Maybe you have as well. But that is not commonplace today. That is not something that figures into the difficulty of most people. Now, I don't know why it was the case, but a lot of people were required and they had to quit jobs or lose jobs over the Sabbath day. By the time I came into the church, there wasn't as much of that. And today, it's almost kind of non-existent. It's not been an issue for most of us, especially if you're younger, to have to deal with, that you would be required to work on a Sabbath. One of our members in El Paso had to move to Odessa recently to take a job. And because of the oil boom there, they said, you know, he was qualified for his job as a machinist. And they said, we are working three shifts a day. We're working 24 hours a day, three shifts, 7 days a week because of the oil boom there. He said, I can't work on Friday night to Saturday night. And they said, fine. And he says, I need some other days off, holy days. And he mentioned all of that before he took the job. They said, that's fine. You know, everybody needs some time off. But we want you to know, if you want to work 7 days a week, you can. But that's not a requirement of the job. And so he took the job. For most of us today, it's not an issue. I haven't heard of somebody losing their job over not working on Saturday in many years. There may have been, but I haven't heard of them. So those cases do happen from time to time. But in our day and age, to have a state-enforced religion or a day of worship is beyond our comprehension almost. But the Bible says that that time is coming. So this individual is going to make that happen. Now, it was somewhat fulfilled in prophecy to a certain degree during the Council of Laodicea, which I'm sure you're aware of, in 364 or 363 A.D. And one of the pronouncements of that particular council, in which I thought it was interesting that one of the other things was a set and a regulation of the canon of the Bible, all of the books of the New Testament, also in the Old Testament, but this mixture of good and evil came in because they made the pronouncement that Christians should not Judaize and be idle on Saturday, but shall work on that day. But the Lord's day they shall especially honor, and as being Christians shall, if possible, do no work on that day. If, however, they're found Judaizing, they shall be anathema from Christ. So that was the stigma that the church, the church-sponsored religion by that time, which had become the religion of the Roman Empire, was enforced. The Sabbath was the only law that was ever altered by the Roman Empire. And the Sabbath is a sign between God and his people. Now, who will be the beast? All of this is a prelude to the rest of the sermon. Who will be the beast? Well, we used to think we knew, we had a pretty good inside track on who that individual would be in the 50s, 60s, and 70s in the Church of God. There was a Bavarian politician who was powerful, and he was dogmatic, and he spoke very forthrightly, and his name was Franz Joseph Strauss. He tried several times running for the chancellorship of Germany, but he was never elected chancellor, but he held other important cabinet positions. But I can tell you for a certainty that Franz Joseph Strauss will never be the beast or the leader of the beast power because he died already. But, so I can be dogmatic on that one. I don't think there's going to be a resurrection. But history shows that there are patterns of human behavior that, along with the broad outline of prophecy, can help us to be aware of future events. And so I'm going to share with you, if you'll look on the page of your beast chart, you will notice your beast chart, just like that's what it's called. after the break, on the far right-hand side, you'll see six revivals of the Holy Roman Empire that no historian disputes. Everyone recognizes that these are revivals and associated with a Holy Roman Empire. It's not a question. And the dates are fairly certain. But there have been six of them so far, as these are detailed. And when you examine all of them, all of these six revivals, there are common characteristics. And I'm putting this in the realm of interesting information, not something to hang your hat on. Hang your hat on this word, but it may help. It may help us to understand what has happened in the past, which may be a prelude to the future. Not guaranteed here. So everybody understand, this is not just speculation for speculation's sake, but research indicates that there are common characteristics, and it does seem to make sense. If it doesn't for you, stick with the Bible. You know, disregard all of this. I'm not going to say disregard the beast chart, because I don't think you should. I think it's valid information. And it's also been very copied, and I don't know if we ever had a copyright on this, or Mr. Armstrong did, but you can find it all over the internet. Other people that have never been associated with any Church of God have plagiarized it and republished it. So you'll find it. You just type into your Google search or Safari search, just type in beast chart, and brink! In a few seconds, you'll find some, and some of them have been altered a little bit, but, you know, oh well. In Revelation 17 and verses 8 through 11, we have kind of gone into this several times now already. We see seven kings or kingdoms. Verse 11, this is interesting. And I forgot to research this, and somebody can research it, probably on your iPhone or smartphone or something, and you'll find one of them. But before the time of Garibaldi, or maybe concurrent with the time of Garibaldi, some historians believe that they know the answer to this, and they may be right. They may be right. I've heard some of our ministers even speculate that this is possible, that there was a Protestant revival of the Holy Roman Empire, and that may be the explanation that happened in Germany. I'm not as familiar with the German kingdoms as some people are. But it says the beast, and I'm not saying that dogmatically that's the answer to this, but it's possible, because you say there's going to be the seventh revival of the Holy Roman Empire, but it mentions this, the beast that was, you know, before it was wounded and is not, it was not for a while, is himself also the eighth, and is of the seven, and is going to perdition, is going to damnation. That's the ultimate fate of this kingdom. And maybe the eighth is that Protestant reformation, if you will, of the Holy Roman Empire of which I spoke. But more importantly, the ten horns which you saw are ten kings who have received no kingdom as yet, but they receive authority for 1 hour as kings with a beast. These are of one mind, and they will give their power and authority to the beast. So we see that through this chapter, also through the previous chapter in Daniel 7, verses 24 and 25, show these same kings, these same seven kings. The first three are destroyed or plucked up, and you'll see that in the chart to the left. To the left under Daniel 7. The first horn, the second horn, the third horn, these are the Vandals, Heruli, Ostrogoths, all part of the whole process, because they emulated the Roman system, and they perpetuated it. And we see the papacy represented by the little horn of Daniel 7 and the other beast of Revelation 13, as I mentioned. Revelation 17 also shows, as we know, that the beast is ridden by a woman, which is a symbol of the church. Now, all of these last six empires that are mentioned from the time of Garibaldi to the time of Garibaldi, all of them share these common characteristics, and there are 10 of them that I'm going to share with you. Revelation 13, we'll begin there with the first one, because the first one is all of these kings and kingdoms have wanted to imitate the classic Roman system of the ancient Roman Empire. Remember when Rome ruled most of the world from 500 BC to 500 AD for roughly 1,000 years? They have wanted to emulate that classical Roman Empire. That has been their desire. Revelation 13, of course, we know John is standing on the sand of the sea, the Mediterranean Sea. He sees this beast. He sees this government rising up out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his horns 10 crowns, and on his head a blasphemous name. And then he goes through the 4 world-ruling empires. And then in verse 3 it says, I saw one of his heads as if it had been mortally wounded, and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world marveled and followed the beast. So they worship the dragon who gave authority to the beast, and they worship the beast, saying, who is like the beast? Who is able to make war with him? This is the same image that is represented in Daniel 7, the last of Daniel's beasts from Nebuchadnezzar's dream in Daniel 2, as well as Daniel's own troubling visions in Daniel 7 are revivals of the Roman Empire. As for the coming beast power, it apparently will strive to imitate Rome, just as the previous 6 incarnations have done. So a likely characteristic, don't bet the farm on it, or even the house, or maybe not even your car, but a likely characteristic that you can look for in the future is that this system will be an imitation of Rome, or will at least be very proud of carrying the inspiration of Rome and claiming the inspiration of Rome. All 6 of the previous empires have had the desire to recapture the grandeur of the Roman system, the Roman Empire. They've had a fascination with the Roman government and how Rome was able to control much of the world. And you know what? When you study history and think about it, the Romans could come across as pretty beneficent conquerors. Because once they conquered you, and as long as you paid your taxes, as long as you didn't rebel, you could keep all your own gods, you could keep all your own temples, you could keep your own way of life, business could be as normal. It could come across as actually being a good thing. Because if you were a Roman citizen, as Paul was, you got the protection of the state as well. Remember, Paul invoked his rights as a Roman citizen several times. And if he was about to be imprisoned, as the book of Acts shows, you know, there are people that were jailers who weren't citizens and or who had bought their citizenship, as the book of Acts, and they shuddered, oh, wow, we have done something really bad. So, you see, it could appear to be something good. It has some good things to emulate. Napoleon said, I am from a race of Caesars. He actually named his own son the King of Rome. And he loved wearing togas. That was an admired piece of clothing for the Napoleon Bonaparte. Mussolini, in the last revival of the Holy Roman Empire, greatly admired Rome. He had dreams of restoring Roman grandeur. You know, it sounds kind of impossible and crazy to us, but that's where they traced their inspiration. You know, we, as people that have lived in a country that is, you know, was the only one in the history of mankind that threw off the shackles of dictatorial power and were able to come up with a constitution that much of it seems to be inspired by the laws of the Bible, find this to be repugnant, don't we? It's coming back, very likely. Hitler and his rallies, you remember seeing the footage, maybe the old films of Hitler at, where it is, the Brandenburg Gate, where people are lined up with military precision, or maybe it's troops, and he is, you know, yelling at the top of his lungs, and people are responding, and they're hanging on every word. That is an imitation of how the emperors would address the legions of Rome and the people of Rome. So we might also expect the coming beast or leader of the beast power to look backwards to the style of the Roman system. The second point is that the Roman Empire is going to have a goal of establishing a far-ranging empire. Rome at its height ruled from the British Isles all the way to India, much of the known world. And all of the previous restorations have sought to have influence, as Rome did for 1,000 years. Again, hoping that they could incorporate many of those kinds of beneficent things that could happen. So over many countries and many peoples, and they'll not want to just exert that influence or power, would be my guess, over just all of Europe, with eventually we'll have 360 million people to rule over, but also much of South America, many of them coming from European descent, Spanish, Italian, Portuguese, and many others who have count that as their descent. In fact, and now there are more Roman Catholics living in South and Central America than any one spot in the world. So they will seek, this system will seek to dominate the entire world. That was their aspiration. That was the aspiration of all six of these revivals, and they didn't succeed. God said no more at times and would not allow it to happen. Mark chapter 10 and verse 42 has something to say about the rulership of man for much of this world's history. And this will be something else that will, in my estimation, be copied or as a part of the Holy Roman Empire's history and its lineage, as a matter of fact, and that is authoritarian rule. And Christ called out the Gentiles specifically in Mark chapter 10 and verse 42 when he called them to himself and said to them, "You know that those who are considered rulers over the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. Yet shall it not so be among you, but whoever desires to become great among you shall be your servant." They had grown up in the Roman system. The disciples had been. That's all they had ever known. That's all they had ever seen. That and the power of the Herodians, people who had life over power over life and death. "And whoever of you desires to be first shall be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many." This is the way, this is not the way, or the way Christ said is not the way Gentiles king ruled, but they ruled with absolute power. And Christ recognized this. Very rarely, in fact, I can't think of a time in the world's history that that power has been used really in a beneficial way overall for mankind, to serve mankind. That is absolute power, rule, and authority. I don't know that you can point to a time in Earth's history when that has been done for the good of others or for the good of the subjects, no matter how people might kid themselves. Prime Minister Thatcher said, "Europe has only been united in tyranny." And I think that that is a statement that will ring true in the future. Revelation 17 and verse 10, again, or pardon me, in verse 12 says, and we've read this before, so if you don't turn back to it, that's fine. You've read it several times now. "The 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings who have received no kingdom as yet, but they receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. These are of one mind. They will give their power and authority to the beast." This ruler is going to have the absolute power and dominion over millions of people on the face of the earth, perhaps billions of people, and it's all going to be given to him and given up by other rulers. Unlimited power usually corrupts. Lord Acton said, "Power corrupts. Absolute power corrupts absolutely." It is a truism. At the feast this year, I was remarking to one of my friends about how beautifully things came together at the feast from a group of people who had really never ever met one another. That is, people who came to serve, and most people do serve at the feast. And we were watching all of the things happening before services and everything falling in like clockwork, as it usually does at the feast. It's because of effort. It's not because it just happens. It's because people want to serve, want to help, want to be there, and all of that sort of thing. And he said, "You know, this feast has been so great." And I said, "Well, it's the product of people wanting to serve. And we just trust that people will have that kind of attitude and they'll come to the feast with a serving attitude. And this is the result." And he looked at me and he said, "Lenin said, trust is good, but control is better." This is the way Gentile leaders control their subjects, as they rule their subjects. The fourth point, which I think ought to be a very obvious one, is papal collaboration, the collaboration of church and state. Now, this is very interesting, and I'm not going to turn to one of these passages because we've turned to it before, so don't get upset. Just jot it down a little bit in your notes when I give it to you. Many times there has been a stormy relationship with each revival, even though they've had a relationship with the church. Sometimes it has been stormy. Sometimes throughout these six revivals, there have been disagreements with the church. For instance, when the Pope in France at that time, because that's where he was about to crown Napoleon, he took the crown from the Pope's head and crowned himself. And there's been this uneasy alliance with many of these revivals of the church. It's been, you know, they've worked together sometimes for, you know, each one's benefit. Christ said in Matthew 12:26 that Satan's kingdom is divided against itself. And this has often been the case with this uneasy relationship between church and state. In 800 AD, Charlemagne was crowned by Pope Leo. 1520, Charles V was crowned ruler of the Holy Roman Empire by Pope Clement. Mussolini and Hitler entered into a concordant with the church in 1933. Now, someone that Mr. LaRavia knows and has met years ago, and from all descriptions was a prince of a person, pardon the pun when I give you the name, but was a gentleman, was an individual that was as far away from this kind of beastly attitude, but he was a descendant of the Habsburg family, Otto von Habsburg. He said that a European culture without its Christian heritage is unthinkable. So there will be, and that's one that we can back up with Scripture, there will be a concordant with the church and state. Every one of these on the right-hand side, lower column, they have all had a relationship with the church, all of them. I mentioned this last time. Although the church is going to confirm the authority of the beast, as it shows in Revelation 13 and 17, eventually that relationship is going to be hated, and the state is going to actually destroy the church. And I mentioned, you know, for what it's worth, this vision of Pope Pius the 10th in 1909, who had this vision that the last pope will leave Rome and will have to walk over the dead bodies of his priests. Here is the fifth, maybe a little bit more difficult to discern similarity between all of the revivals of the Holy Roman Empire. Every single one of them had been dominated by a German head. The pattern of the government was Roman. This was carried on in history by the Germans, and let's just go through them. Charlemagne was a German Frank. Karl der Große, or Charles the Great, was his name. His capital was in Aachen, Germany. Aachen was later a town that my father visited in 1945 as the 29th Division went through there. I've seen films of it. He had films that were taken by army photographers. They literally destroyed Aachen, and it was pretty gruesome to see the bodies laying around on the battlefield, but I've got that somewhere in our VHS library, probably in the garage. But pretty gruesome thing. But that's where Charlemagne grew up. Justinian the Great, many people think he was Greek, but actually his descendancy is of Illyrian descent. Germanic tribes had conquered that area, anciently speaking, and some historians conclude that the origin of several family proper names, that the family was actually Teutonic or German in origin. Now, what about Napoleon, you might say? He's French. Everybody knows he was French. Actually, Napoleon was not French. He was born in Corsica. He was Corsican by birth. He actually didn't speak French until he was 10 years old. His family has been traced back to 11th century Florentine Italy, which was settled as a Lombard duchy. A Germanic tribe conquered North Italy and settled there. He was a German Lombard. Hard to believe. Again, in 1806, he crowned himself. Didn't allow the Pope to do it. He crowned himself with the Iron Crown of Lombardy. Hitler dominated the Sixth Revival. He was of Austrian descent, which is basically of Germanic background at any rate. And, of course, Otto the Great and the Habsburg dynasty were also of Germanic origin. There is a Germanic legend that the last emperor of Europe will be another Charles de Grossa, or Charles the Great. And, of course, I mentioned the Catholic prophecy tying in the man of sin. The last pope will be Petrus Romanus, or Peter the Roman. Interesting things, again, not something to hang your hat on, but something to be aware of, these potential characteristics that may, in fact, come to pass. Isaiah chapter 10 and verse 5 speaks of Assyria. You know, if you want a good book to read about European history, get the book The Europeans by Luigi Barzini. It's incredible. Especially incredible is its chapter, and very informative chapter, on the Germans, because he takes nation by nation and isolates them and talks about their tendencies and their characteristics. And stunning to me was the fact that, and of course, we love the German people. We're not bashing Germans or anything. One time I gave a sermon on Germany and prophecy, and somebody accused me of bashing Germans. I'm not bashing Germans. I'm just telling you what the Bible says and what history records. All peoples have their trouble spots and problems, blind spots and whatever. I hope that's a good enough qualification. But the German people are inventive. They're industrious. They built themselves up after World War II. They are incredible. I know people in the church in Germany, and probably some of you do, and you know, all people everywhere that are touched by God are wonderful. We know that. But nations do have national characteristics. And Barzini describes the Germanic people as evolving in even just a generation from being innkeepers and farmers and workers of trades in the 1800s, sitting around the coal-fired stoves in a general store and smoking pipes and being very peaceful and coddling their grandchildren, to becoming several generations this nation that wants to take over the world. And it's happened several times in the 20th century. Isaiah 10 and verse 5 says, "Woe to Assyria, the rod of my anger, and the staff in whose hand is my indignation. God will use Assyria for his purpose. I will send him against an ungodly nation and against the people of my wrath. I will give him charge to seize the spoil, to take the prey, and to tread them down like the mire of the streets. Yet he does not mean so, nor does his heart think so." It's just reactionary. It's in his heart to destroy and cut off not a few nations. The speculation that we can derive from history is that there is a great possibility that the beast of Revelation will be of Germanic stock. The sixth characteristic is the involvement of the beast powers, or the revival of the Holy Roman Empires, in the Middle East, and specifically with the Arab world at times. Psalm 83 is a prophecy that shows the alliance of the beast power in the end time with the Middle East. Psalm 83 is a quick read, but it gives this interesting observation about what is going to happen at the time of the end. "Do not keep silent, O God, and do not keep your peace, and do not be still, O God. For behold, your enemies make a tumult, and those that hate you have lifted up their head." This is a prophecy of the end time. "They have taken crafty counsel against your people and consulted against your sheltered ones. They have said, 'Come, let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel may be remembered no more.' For they have consulted together with one consent. They form a confederacy against you, the tents of Edom and the Ishmaelites, Moab and the Hagrites, Gebel, Ammon and Amalek, Philistia with the inhabitants of Tyre. Assyria also has joined with them, and they have helped the children of Lot." The description of what they do is categorized in the book of Obadiah, in one of the shortest prophecies of the minor prophets. And for that, they have earned as Isaiah 63 brings out, they have earned the first act of Christ's retribution when he returns to earth And you can read Isaiah 63 as it shows that Christ is coming back from Edom and from Bozra. His blood is filling his garments because of the slaughter that he has caused, because of this, because of what they have done to the people of Israel. In 1798, Napoleon had a campaign in the Middle East, but he courted Islamic favor and publicly honored the prophet Muhammad. Justinian the Great had Eastern wars with Persia, but later signed a peace treaty with them. Charlemagne was friendly with Harun al-Rashid, the caliph of Baghdad, who ruled the Islamic world. Charles V courted the favor of Suleiman the Magnificent. Mussolini invaded Libya and marched into Tripoli. And of course, we know that Hitler, his main object was Palestine as he drove his Panzer tanks, but he was stopped. Rommel was stopped in that quest. Sometimes in history, God says, that's as far as you go. And they haven't had the power that this beast power in its final incarnation will have. Prophecy shows that Assyria will be allied with the Arab nations against modern Israel prior to Christ's return. The seventh characteristic of all of these revivals has been British opposition, and they have been a reluctant partner in the European Union. And they've always been at odds with the Gentile revivals of the Holy Roman Empire. Napoleon desperately wanted to conquer England. Again, they have this in their attitude to have world domination. Britain, England, was the most powerful nation on the face of the earth when Napoleon came to power, and he strove to conquer it. He was met his match at the Battle of Trafalgar by Admiral Nelson, and then at other wars as well. Caesar invaded Britain, but the Roman legions were called back to Rome later on because of local problems. So British opposition has always been something, and it certainly will be something that will, I think, you can look for in the future. Eighth, this empire has always had an association with the occult. And we know this is no, this should not come as any surprise. Satan gives his authority in Revelation 13 and verse 2. But a similar spirit, and that will be the most fantastic expression of Satan's power ever at the time of the end. But each of these revivals has had their association with a cult. Caesar Augustus would not step outside his room in the morning until his horoscope was read to him each day. Napoleon and his wife Josephine believed in fortune-telling. Tarot card reading was common in the palace. They had numerous mystical experiences in life. They saw a spiritual message in the king's chamber of the Great Pyramid. They consulted with an Egyptian soothsayer. Here's one that's interesting from Justinian the Great. He's described by his associates. He and his wife were described as associates by his associates as demons in human bodies. One servant claimed to have seen a strange form entering the king's body while he was asleep in his chambers. He rarely slept, ate, or drank, it's recorded. Somewhat different as far as a lifestyle, you'll agree. Charlemagne, many claimed that he had an unusual clairvoyance or ability to tell the future and predict the outcome of events. He relied on occult advisors. The court secretary and advisor to Charles V was a magician. Otto the Great, Hitler, and Mussolini all had their astrologers. Hitler's advisors claimed that at times he had a strange force that would overtake him. During the Nuremberg trials, the generals of Hitler were questioned, why did you allow this to happen? Any sane, rational, normal person would not allow this to go unchecked. And to a man, they all said, you have not seen the Führer in his fury. A supernatural force would overtake him. Daniel 8 in verse 23, we've read this already, but I'll read from the King James Version because I think that it is very interesting. Now, I'm almost finished, but I'm going to apologize to you for going over time. I usually like to speak 50 minutes, but I didn't want to make this a two-part sermon. And I wanted to finish it all, and I told Terry, I said, I don't feel I can leave any of this out and give you the complete picture of what to expect in the time of the end. So I'll beg your forgiveness, because I'm past an hour right now, and I really don't like to do that. So Please bear with me for just a few more minutes. In the latter time of their kingdom, when transgressors are come to the full, a king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences shall stand up. That's in the King James. Some commentators feel this refers to occult powers. And of course, we know, as we read last time, that Revelation 16 and verse 13 shows unclean spirits coming out of the beast. In Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 12, we fight against the prince of the power of the air. That power, as Paul said in Thessalonians, has been restrained and will be restrained until the man of sin is revealed. This last revival, brethren, is going to be the last shot of the devil. And we can be sure that the previous six revivals have just been a forerunner of the kind of involvement that Satan will have with the individuals and with the governments that they are occupied by. Remember, the Bible shows that at this time the power of the occult, Satan, is going to be unleashed in its full fury. Revelation 12 and verse 12 says that Satan knows that he has just a short time. Vatican Hill, from the Latin, is interpreted as the place of divination. The ninth and penultimate characteristic of the Holy Roman Empire revivals has been the ability to exploit crises. And in fact, that is what has brought all of them to power. And we could probably discern that it's not going to be any different. History has shown that the individual who would be qualified as the head of the beast has been a master at exploiting a crisis in order to seize power. Unity has never historically come to the Roman Empire as a result of a natural process. And that is why the natural process that has begun 60 years ago of the unification of Europe has never resulted in a unified Europe that would result in this explanation of a revived Holy Roman Empire. When there's hopelessness and when there's fear, people cry out for a strong man. Before Napoleon, there was a revolution and terror in France. Otto the Great emerged and was looked at as a deliverer. Mussolini and Hitler capitalized on the collapse of an economic system during the Great Depression. Now, perhaps as a forerunner, it's very interesting, as I mentioned, that there is going to be absolute power exercised by this beast. And interestingly enough, in this Cypriot crisis, where there are, that has all of the ramifications of trouble and problems, not to alarm anybody, but you know what has happened in Cyprus recently. Cyprus is a tax-free haven. Cyprus is a place that many Russian oligarchs and billionaires have deposited billions and billions of euros, thinking they're protected. Cyprus has also gone bankrupt and can't support itself. It has no industry. It may in the future, it has large gas finds and gas oil fields off of its coast, and it may well be flush in the future, but right now it's in a world of hurting. And the powers of the European Union basically dictated to them that to get solvent, you've got to take control of 40% of all the bank deposits. Now, how do you think that that has made Vladimir Putin feel? Not too happy. In Daniel 11 and verse 40, don't turn there, but we know that this beast power, when it surrounds Jerusalem, when it plants its palaces there, is going to hear tidings out of the north. That is going to be Russia. It is a forerunner, in my opinion, not a fulfillment. It is something that you could easily see these things shaping up in prophecy in the near future. Tensions are rising. They've tried to unify for 50 years in a peaceful manner, but it hasn't worked. And there are rumblings, there are financial problems and discord in Europe. The euro hasn't brought about the unity of the banking system and the economic system that a lot of people had a promise in, despite the fact that, you know, you've got a woman, looks like she's riding a beast on the coin of the euro. I mean, it has all the markings of the beast, but it's not. And the euro may not last. So look for crisis exploitation. And the last point is, as we know, very simply, divine intervention, divine intervention. I'm closing on this particular point because we know that God is going to intervene when all of this happens. He eventually will intervene in the events of man as Christ returns, as he has through history, to stop these revivals. And they were obliterated in the end of the 19th and 20th centuries by the people of Israel. They were stopped. God allowed Israel to stop them two times from taking over the world. But until that time, we might expect the coming beast to be a student of classical Rome, one who will be able to exploit a crisis situation, of Germanic descent, who will collaborate with the Roman Catholic Church. Before I conclude today, I want to place you into the time frame of these events. God has made it possible for you to be unleavened, to be without sin. He has provided a Passover lamb, Jesus Christ, to cover your sins. He has made you and brought you to this particular point. And you know what? I'll repeat this, what I mentioned, because not all of you are here in the first Holy Day. If you ever begin to think that you're insignificant as a person in life, in the church, that God doesn't love you, doesn't care for you, then just take a look around at everybody here and everybody that you know that is in the church, and then go out into the world and take a look at everybody else that is not here and it is not a part of this information and this advanced knowledge. God loves his people. Daniel 11 in verse 32 is one of the greatest promising passages in all of Bible prophecy. Notice what Daniel says about you. Such as do wickedly against the covenant shall he corrupt by flatteries, but the people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits, and they that understand among people shall instruct many. I take that to mean that teaching about God's kingdom will replace the one and about the kingdom of God that is going to replace this oppressive kingdom that is coming upon the earth will change lives, will actually change and provide hope for the rest of mankind, or at least for those that God is going to bring salvation to. Revelation 12 and verse 10 says, I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, now is come salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ, for the accuser of our brethren is cast down, which accuse them before God day and night. There is no question that from the standpoint of this casting down, that will be the time of Satan's vast exploration into influencing the events of mankind to somehow try to destroy him, even though it's hopeless, and even though God is greater and God is better. This is his last shot. This is when the man of sin will probably be revealed. Not that he hasn't been cast down anciently from out of God's throne, but this appears to be the time in which the church will face persecution, but God's people will be strong. As an individual, though, I said, how do you place yourself into this time frame of future events? Fearful? Confident? Scared out of your mind? How do you feel? How do you feel about the future? You need to place yourself into these future events, not to scare yourself to death, but you need to realize that this is coming upon the world, and you are being warned now about these things, to take them seriously, to take the days of unleavened bread seriously, to take the holy days of God seriously, to take the Sabbath day seriously, and to honor God. That is what you have been called to do. They overcame him by the blood of the Lamb. That is the message of the Passover. And by the word of their testimony, you can put leaven out from here till the kingdom come, and you're not going to earn salvation. You're not going to make yourself right with God. That has been done for you as a free, unmerited gift. If necessary, some will love not their lives unto the death. We hope that that happens to nobody, here at least. But we don't need to fear the times ahead, brethren. God sent his Son to become our Passover lamb. We have been cleansed from all sin. That is one of the things you should have thought about as you left the Passover that evening, that you have been cleansed from all sin. And during these days, as Paul says in 1 Corinthians 5, you are unleavened. The beast has not appeared on the scene yet. These days are still ahead of us, maybe some decade or decades. I don't know. I would guess, judging by the times that we're living in, that he is alive. And right now, if he is alive, he's getting ready for bed. And he may have even kissed his children goodnight before he went to bed. Let's watch and be prepared spiritually so that we ourselves are ready for these coming future events.